VRC with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, and welcome to episode number 145 of the Robots podcast. My name is Jana, and today's episode will be all about the DARPA Robotics Challenge. But first, I'd like to alert you to the fact that we're currently still running a fundraising campaign. As a not-for-profit organization, we, the people behind the Robots podcast, are looking for vital funds to keep the podcast going. So if you would like to make a donation, it's not too late. The campaign will still run until 16th of December. Simply visit our website at robotspodcast.com and you'll find all the instructions right there. And now, as always, let's get the latest news and developments in robotics from Christine.
Thank you, Jana. In the past week, Apple, Amazon, Google and UPS have all made headlines by announcing major investments in robotics. Apple announced that they were investing $10.5 billion in supply chain robots and automation equipment, and recently confirmed their acquisition of PrimeSense, the developer of the Kinect, for $350 million. Amazon, the company which spent $750 million to buy robotics company Kiva Systems in 2012, unveiled their new PrimeAir concept, which uses small octocopters to deliver packages to your doorstep by air. UPS revealed that they were also researching delivery drones that could compete with Amazon's PrimeAir service. And Google publicly announced that they have set up a robotics division headed by the man behind the Android operating system, Andy Rubin, and has quietly acquired seven robotic companies to jumpstart this new operation in the past 6 months. In other news, the forensic pathologists have developed the autopsy robot Vertobot, which some of you may remember from our earlier report in 2009. They have released a video of their second prototype system installed at the University of Zurich. And the new robot allows for automatic tool change and increased accuracy. It can systematically take photos from predefined positions, perform 3D optical surface scans of the body, perform a CT scan, and perform needle autopsies. Vertobot is now also accurate enough for use in biopsies in a forensic setting. As always, you can find much more information on this week's news, including in-depth coverage and analysis of Apple's, Amazon's, UPS's, and Google's robotics program, and a video of the pathologist Vertobot. Visit us at robohub.org.
Paul O is professor at the Drexel College of Engineering in Philadelphia and leads the team behind the DARPA Robotics Challenge, or DRC for short. The DRC team includes a whole range of other universities in the US and the Korea Advanced Institute of Science. The DRC is all about working to advance robotics technology for disaster relief, responding to a challenge that was put forward by the US Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. The challenge involves enabling a full-size humanoid robot to be deployed in disaster zone scenarios that will require it to drive vehicles, navigate difficult environments, use tools, and manipulate equipment. Paul O spoke to our interviewer Sabine about the idea behind the DRC, the different challenges involved, and its potential to change responses to major disasters in the future.
Hi, Paul. Welcome to Robots.
Hi, Sabine.
Can you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. My name is Paul O. I'm a roboticist. I'm a professor of mechanical engineering at Drexel University in Philadelphia. And I also have, the honor and pleasure of being the lead for Team DRC Hubo, and that's for the DARPA Robotics Challenge.
What's your vision at the Drexel Autonomous Systems Lab?
Well, our vision was really birthed in large part with what happened in 9/11. I joined Drexel in 2000, and that was after living in New York City for about 7 years. And about a year after I joined, of course, was 9/11, and a lot of my friends and family were directly impacted. And so, like many others around the nation, we were trying to wonder what we can do to help. And so the idea of being able to apply our robots for disaster response, for humanitarian assistance, became kind of like our mission statement.
And this whole idea of disaster response is really what's behind the DARPA Robotics Challenge this year. Can you tell us a bit more about this challenge?
Oh, absolutely. Let me just start off that the DRC, or the DARPA Robotics Challenge, is unprecedented. And it is really epic. And I think it's going to be probably the biggest robotics show, at least in this decade. It revolves around, it was motivated by what happened in the 2011 Fukushima nuclear accident after the tsunami. And so DARPA conceived of a challenge that consists of 8 events. And it ranges from a robot driving a vehicle to, you know, climbing ladders, you know, breaking through walls with hand tools. And it's a real test of what, you know, robots can do to assist in disaster response.
DRC is really focused on humanoids. Why is that?
You know, that's a good question. It's been asked several times. What we saw in Fukushima was that there were plenty of tools, there were plenty of vehicles. This happened, you know, in what we call human-centered environment, like that. It was a nuclear power plant. And, you know, you wanted a robot that could operate in these human-centered environments and use human tools. And so I think just naturally what you're seeing is a lot of the DRC robots have that kind of human form factor, you know, about the size, about approximately the size of a rescue worker. So that's probably why you're seeing that it's humanoid, even though it's not called a DARPA Humanoid Challenge. It's called a DARPA Robotics Challenge.
Let's look a bit more at your team. What did it take for you to qualify for the DRC, and what are some of the steps ahead? Tell us about your team as well.
Sure. We could start off with talking about our team. It's somewhat unique in several regards. But first off, it is, Drexel is leading a 10-university effort for this DRC. These are universities that cover the entire spectrum of U.S. education, like a small versus large universities, private and public teaching and research universities. Another distinguishing element of ours is that we have a Korean university as a partner. So, you know, I'm a very strong advocate for international research collaborations, and that's why we've partnered up with KAIST in Korea. In terms of qualifying, it began with submitting proposal back in May of 2012. We had the kickoff in October, where we learned that we were one of the 7 Track A teams. And about 9 months after that, in the middle of June of 2013, is when DARPA visited each team in what they call a critical design review, to see which teams would go forward, to see if they've made enough progress, and to see if they, if they've been meeting their schedules. And so we were happy to learn that we passed CDR. In October, DARPA requested qualification videos. So each team had to show their robot doing some walking, some valve turning. They kind of had to show that it had, safety precautions in place. And now we're here. We're about 29 days until the trials in Miami.
Congratulations. I really like this idea of international collaboration, and you mentioned the KAIST. I'm guessing that's why you went for the Hubo robot. Can you tell us a bit more about this robot and why you chose it?
Sure. So Hubo is a humanoid that was conceived and designed by KAIST. And KAIST is a premier university in Korea. And, you know, arguably people would say that Hubo is on par with the Honda Asimo, at least in terms of form and in function. But I would say the distinguishing difference between Hubo and Asimo is that Hubo is open architecture. In other words, all the hardware and the software are open so that people can look under the hood, they can make their own changes, they can customize. Whereas the Honda Asimo is very closed, tight proprietary system. And so for researchers and developers, the Hubo has just been a much easier and better platform for development. We began our first collaboration with KAIST back in 2007. That was a time when the National Academies were saying that a real urgent and important need is for American engineering students to have the skills to work in a global workforce. In other words, they wanted engineers who could, effectively work with counterparts in other countries. And so I thought that if we used Hubo kind of as a case study, you would get a lot of American students who are excited to work with humanoids, who would be willing to spend time in Korea at the Hubo lab and effectively, learn hands-on what humanoid design is all about. So Drexel acquired its first Hubo in 2008. Over 10 students from Drexel each spent 6 months in Korea. They learned the language. They got really embedded with the labs. Hubo Lab taught us about hardware design. We shared with them about software design. In 2010, again through the National Science Foundation, we acquired 6 more Hubos, and we distributed those robots to other universities in the United States. And the purpose of that was to try to really advance the science underlying humanoids. I mean, I could go on and on.
No, it's fast. So what I'm wondering is, you mentioned 10 universities, which is really a huge team and must be tricky to coordinate. And now you say that there's 6 Hubos distributed across the U.S. So is that the different parts of the team? Are each one of these universities working with a Hubo to help you guys?
Right. So some of those partners that received Hubos are on the DRC Hubo team. The offer was made out to the others to join us, but they wanted to have their own teams, and they were going to develop other robots. But I thought that for the DRC, the only way I think you could really participate in the challenge was if, you had a very well-financed infrastructure, probably tens or if not hundreds of millions of dollars, as well as, a whole army of engineers. And so, it's no surprise that you see like NASA, involved in the DRC. In Japan, of course, they have a very long history. I think the idea is, even to me in the beginning, was you had to be big and rich to be involved with DRC. But I woke up the next day and I said to myself, it is imperative that we participate in this DRC because it's a very, meaningful purpose, disaster response. And I said, also that, you know, as a professor, as a teacher, that, you know, to have my students participate in something that's bigger and more important than any individual. You know, the idea of being able to help save lives is something that's really important and dear to my heart, as I mentioned about 9/11 and things. So, you know, the way I thought about it, if we're not big and rich, well, I have 7 Hubos. There's 8 events for the DRC. So why don't I use a divide and conquer approach? I have a proven platform. Maybe it's not perfectly suited for the DRC events, but we can upgrade them. We have a running start. So the idea was I'd give a Hubo to my partner, you know, one of these 9 other universities, and have them work on a single event, for example, just ladder climbing. That by divide and conquer, I think we could, you know, meet this enormous time pressure that the DRC is imposing on us. So although people, you know, often comment, oh, you have such a large team, how could you possibly manage it? To the contrary, I think we have a much more agile and much more tactical team than many others who are just trying to invent everything by themselves.
Yeah, you know, that I think that really makes sense. I hadn't realized that before. Can you tell us a bit more about what Hubo can do and also maybe compare it to Atlas, which is the other humanoid that's competing in the competition?
Sure. You know, the original Hubo, I think, is about the same size as a 10-year-old boy. So that gives you some context. You know, it has the ranges of motion, like a 10-year-old boy. But you wouldn't imagine sending a 10-year-old boy to a disaster site. You'd rather send in, you know, a 20-something-year-old, you know, firefighter. And so, in other words, we'd have to beef it up. And so the DRC Hubo evolved to its current state, where it has longer legs, longer arms, much stronger hands, stronger motors. It is basically using electric motors compared to the Atlas, which is using, you know, hydraulics. It is a bit shorter than the Atlas, but it's also to its advantage that a single person can carry and lift and transport a Hubo. I mean, you can't do that with an Atlas. So I imagine a disaster response, you could envision the first responders or the incident commanders trying to carry this robot from place to place. The Hubo is the size and weight is conducive to that. Atlas, I think you need to have some sort of motorized winches and possibly even a forklift to transport it. So, you know, in trying to be realistic with disaster response, I think the Hubo has, you know, a lot of advantages in its form factor.
The DRC trials are coming up December 2021. What will your robot need to do for these trials specifically?
So specifically, there's 8 events. The first one is to drive a vehicle from point A to point B. That vehicle is an unmodified utility car. The specific one is a Polaris vehicle. After that, event 2 is rough terrain walking. And so you can imagine in a disaster site, a lot of rock, debris. The robot needs to walk over that. The third event is that there is debris, and the robot has to clear it out. The fourth one is to open doors and to walk through them. The fifth one is to use a hand tool to break through a wall. Again, the idea that disaster response, that this is what a first responder might need to do because something's breached. The next event is to climb a ladder. And that's followed by event 7, which is to turn a valve. And then finally, event 8 is about, dragging hoses and connecting them to pipes.
I know a lot of these tasks are difficult to do. Why are they difficult, and how far are you from being ready? Like, do you already have some of these that you can mark off your checklist?
Sure. Indeed, these are very difficult events. And I think your first part of the question is what makes it difficult. I think in answering that question, there's an enormous amount of motion planning that we as human beings take for granted. Something like getting into a car, I think a lot of us just take that for granted. And that's what's so difficult about it. Why can't you get a robot to do that? And I say, okay, just think about, like, my grandfather. He's not as strong as he used to be. For him to get in the car it takes a long time. He does it very, very carefully. I think anybody that's had any back injury or has some muscle pain can appreciate that getting in the car and getting out of it isn't always that easy. And it's done very slowly and carefully planned. In that sense, that's what our robots are like right now. Not because they don't have strong enough motors, but it's about maintaining that balance and not tumbling and hurting itself. Okay? And the same thing goes with ladder climbing. We might take it for granted, but once you start to think, I have a sprained ankle, or my ankle's not as strong as my other foot, that you realize, hey, I got to maintain balance, and how do I do that? So hopefully that answered the question a little bit about the difficulty. What was your follow-on question?
How far along are you?
Okay. We've demonstrated, at least in the lab, all 8 events. We tried to do that as how DARPA has described each event. So we already have, our Hubo driving a Polaris vehicle. We have it climbing the ladders, using hand tools. And a lot of that's already on our DRC website, as well as some of the YouTube videos.
Is this more about research or about integration? So you're talking about these challenges. Do you feel like more research is needed, or is it about putting together the different pieces that we've developed as roboticists?
Mm-hmm. So, that's an excellent question. Indeed, I see the DRC, because of the time pressures and because of the very specific event and how they define the event, that this isn't really real about research. It is about systems integration. It is about engineering design. To fit within a schedule and in a budget and about resources. But on the other side, we are a team of academics. And we also believe that there's a lot of research that comes out of it. And in fact, we've published this in IEEE conferences. And I believe we're probably the only team that has actually published to date papers on it. So, I feel that this is not a competition. It's called a challenge. And that's really appealing to me as a professor and I believe as a taxpayer. Funds are being made available, and we like to have this information shared and so that knowledge can increase. So I really encourage, other teams to, I know they want to keep their secret sauce together. But at the same time, we owe it to the community, and this is about disaster response, to try to share in the information and about lessons learned.
Yeah, that's an excellent message. I'm wondering in terms of what happens after. So if you have these different pieces, you've solved these different challenges, how do you put them together to actually do disaster scenarios? What would a typical disaster response look like in the field in the longer term?
That is interesting. We put out a concept of operations notional video very early on in the challenge. We did that. It's on YouTube. It's back in October 2012. And it essentially says, this is our vision of disaster response in the year 2020. And I think when people see the video, they would say, wow, that's science fiction. We're not going to see that for another 50 or 100 years. But I put 2020 because that's only 7 years away. And in my observations, we see these disruptive, transformative technologies only taking, less than a decade to make their impact. And I think the driverless car challenges are an excellent example of that. So, the 2004, 2007, driverless car competition, some people said that that was science fiction. But, today, you have a Google car, you have Mercedes and BMW licensing some of these technologies. They're in the high-end options on their luxury cars. So I do believe that the outcomes of this DRC will be felt, within the decade. Which aspects of them? I think that will be driven largely by the particular need. I'm personally very interested in humanoids that drive vehicles. I know that kind of goes contrary to the people pursuing driverless cars, but when I look at the economic side of it, humanoid prices will continue to drop. And they can be simply reprogrammed to drive particular vehicles that are unmodified. And so that could be a huge impact to companies that have to train individual people to drive highly specialized vehicles. It could also be used in situations where, it's important to have a co-pilot. So you can imagine that. Whether it's a spaceship and you have only an astronaut, and something happens to the captain, could the robot take over control and drive?
It's interesting because all the different scenarios you gave here, like the robot driving the car, et cetera, are scenarios that go beyond the search and rescue type of operation. And so do you see these challenges as a good way to drive innovation to really hopefully spill out into other areas of robotics and other applications?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think the driverless car challenges is a good example where the direct benefits to industry and consumer are more immediate. Okay? But it also spun off a lot of other technology developments like computer vision and navigation systems. I see with the DRC, Hubo, the DRC event in total, advancing our understanding of path planning, and of perception and of truly dexterous manipulation. So these are all areas they have very deep roots, long history of effort, but that's exactly what challenges like this do. They catalyze the development.
What is the final challenge after the trials?
After the trials, there'll be finalists. And they'll be given 12 more months to continue. It'll be the same events, but probably they'll increase the level of difficulty. And ways they'll do that would be to have certain levels of autonomy, certain levels of communication, bandwidth limitations and latencies. So, DARPA is going to continue to raise the level of difficulty.
What levels of autonomy are we looking at? For most of these scenarios, is it really more teleoperation, or is it more tell the robot to go climb the stairs and then it does what it needs to do?
Right. So there's a good range of that. And I think you'll see a lot of teams in Miami teleoperating their system. Some of them, it would be what's called shared autonomy or supervised autonomy. The human operator might get a video and say, okay, the valve is right over there. Click that area with their mouse, and then the robot would go and figure out where it needs to place the hand and turn the valve. For our DRC team, we have autonomy in several of the events. The one Drexel's doing with driving, the sensor head detects any obstacles in the road and steers the vehicle accordingly. So that's not a teleoperation event. It just shows what you can do with good perception and coordinated motion planning.
You mentioned that DARPA would be increasing the challenge difficulty. Do they take into account your feedback?
Absolutely. They do that in a number of mechanisms. Back in October at the 2013 Humanoids Conference, the DARPA leadership asked all the team leads to give them feedback, also try to transparently show their progress. And I think the lessons learned for DARPA over there were, you know, things like, you know, maybe hands might need strengthening, or we might have to make the weight of certain things lighter. DARPA also followed that up with individual phone calls, so private calls to team leads. Again, asking them for candid feedback on performance. So I think the way, you know, DARPA is trying to do it, you know, they call it a Goldilocks approach. You know, make it not too easy, but not too hard. Try to find that sweet spot so that, you know, everybody's pushed to try to do better.
I love that you mentioned before that this is a great way to get students involved and excited about doing robotics. I also started robotics through competitions. I was working on RoboCup. What are some of the, you know, what's the ambience of the team and some of the successes or anecdotes or fun moments that you've been through so far?
I think a real tipping point for us as a team was over the summer. But by design, you know, we are 10 institutions, and it's not frequently that we can get all together. So I took advantage of the summer break to rent out the dorms on campus, and I called all our student members to spend, you know, 10 weeks with us. And so, you know, that really, helped to build the camaraderie amongst the different students, where, you know, they took over classrooms, they shared code, they helped each other out, try to identify, you know, best practices. You know, after they worked all day, they would go out and you know, hit the town of Philadelphia, enjoy themselves. They would eat in the dining halls together. So they really became tight, a real band of brothers. And I think, if anything, that's going to be something they'll remember for the rest of their lives.
That brings me to the...
Anecdotally, that's the fun part.
Mm-hmm. That brings me to the next question is, how will you define success for your team?
How do I define success for a team? In that regard, I think we've already achieved success. You know, on the kind of warm and fuzzies, we could say that, you know, we all feel like we're making a contribution to promote and push disaster response through robotic technologies. It's all cool. We're making cool robots. But when you ask the question, why are you doing this, the immediate response from our students is because it's about saving people's lives. So to have that reason, you know, raison d'etre, or wanting to do something so so moving for me. As an academic, we've met, you know, our benchmark of success. Publishing is very important to us, and letting our colleagues know the state of the art. That's been done, so that's why we try to be very transparent. That's why we have a blog, showcase things. We're very honest about what worked, what doesn't work. But, you know, ultimately, I want our team members to be able to tell their grandkids that they won this DARPA Robotics Challenge.
That would be pretty neat.
So, you know, that's what we're pushing for. But it's not I don't think it's the sole reason, you know, we have sleepless nights and we put our blood, sweat, and tears into this.
You're also an expert in aerial vehicles and ground vehicles. How do you see these things fitting together in the grander picture?
Oh, I love this question. yes, you know, thanks for noticing that. I did a large part of my academic career is known for UAV work or unmanned aerial vehicles. And it was only about 2007 that I started doing humanoids, and I told you the reasons why. It was about training students, about international collaboration. It wasn't that I really cared about humanoids at the time, but it was a great case study to encourage and motivate and train students to work with, you know, ones overseas. Mathematically, in my mind, humanoids and UAVs are very similar, if not identical. And I know people, that's not intuitive.
Yeah, I'm scratching my head. Right? Tell me how, yeah.
So I said number one rule with UAVs is don't crash, right? You're flying, don't crash. That's the number one rule, okay? Humanoids, the number one rule is don't fall down, okay? You're walking or whether you're balancing on one foot or you're climbing a ladder, the rule is don't stumble and fall. So mathematically, you know, we could derive all these equations. It's all about a stability issue. And my vision for UAVs was about putting, you know, manipulators and hands on UAVs. Because, you know, every single, you know, right now, I think UAVs are what I call passive devices. They fly around, don't hit anything. You know, take some video and give us situational awareness. I call that passive device. But my vision for UAVs has been about being active devices. I want them to fly, you know, around buildings and maybe caves and tunnels. And I want them, if there's a branch in the way, I want you to grab that branch and move it. If you're flying around inside a work area, I want you to go and fetch a tool for me. Or I want you to fly under the bridge and repair that rivet. And that's what I mean by an active device. That's flying. It's a UAV that has hands, it has, you know, has limbs. In that regard, humanoids are very, very similar, except they're not, you know, free-floating. So, you know, that's why I see that UAVs and humanoids are very similar, and mathematically, you know, we could have the framework that shows that they're similar. So you could design it, you know, your rules, your control laws. It doesn't matter whether it's a UAV, an underwater robot with arms, or a space robot with arms, or a humanoid with arms. So that's kind of the grander vision, you know, this of our, you know, scientific pursuit.
All right. Well, thanks, Paul, for being here with us on Robots, and good luck on the challenge.
Thank you very much.
And that's all for today. Remember that there is still time to submit your entry to our annual Festive Holiday Video Competition that is open to audio and video entries around the holidays and, of course, robotics. If you've got an entry, just visit our website at robotspodcast.com to submit it. We'll pick some of the best entries to feature on our dedicated YouTube channel. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Until then, goodbye. DRC with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.